welcome to the Radiological Science in the Context of Radiological Terrorism podcast lecture series. In this podcast, Dr. Sally Amundson of Columbia University will present her lecture entitled Gene Expression and Molecular Signaling Responses to Radiation.
So a continuation of this theme of biological effects here. And just as a general overview of the things I kind of want to impart to you today, I'll be discussing many signaling pathways that respond to radiation, and really I'll just be focusing on one as an example, but always I want you to keep in mind that there are many different pathways by which cells can respond to radiation. And also that exposure to radiation causes changes in gene expression. And these changes do underlie many of the cellular and whole animal effects that you see. So they're important on the molecular level. And also, we now live in an age of wonderful technology where we can study these changes essentially across the whole genome. So we can see a snapshot of gene expression of all the genes. And this can be very valuable for many things, and also in this specific context. And also, I want to try to start to convince you that gene expression profiles may actually provide useful information for biodosimetry. So again, like Charles, I want to kind of wind up with a little pitch for our center and one of the approaches that we're taking for developing biodosimeters. So when we think of the effects of radiation on living cells, unfortunately, I think a lot of that is biased by movies and television. And, of course, these are not the real effects. We don't create monsters or superheroes. But we do have a number of effects on the level of the whole organism, and we'll hear more about that tomorrow. And also on the cellular and molecular level over here, we've heard some already about DNA repair, mutation, chromosomal aberrations, and we'll be hearing more about DNA repair and damage also in the next talk. But what I want to focus on is signal transduction and sort of see this as one of the first responses of the cell after the initial DNA damage. How does a cell know that it's damaged, and what does it do next? How does it get up to these cancer and these types of effects that you may have heard more about? So again, just to review, I guess Charles already essentially said this. Some of the main cellular consequences can include arrest of the cell cycle. So when cells are irradiated, they can stop dividing, and they can either do this permanently, just never not die, but never divide again, or they can do this temporarily. And part of that will allow them time for DNA repair. They can try to stick those chromosomes back together, hopefully in the correct order. But if they're unsuccessful at that, they can also die. And there are a number of different mechanisms for cell death by radiation. But one of them is actually a programmed cell death, so there's a whole series of genes that are dedicated just to killing a cell when it really needs to die. So these are some of the major cellular consequences. And again, as I said, underlying this, there's a horribly complicated network of signal transduction. And this is just one attempt in a paper a few years back now of trying to make a schematic of what's involved in DNA repair. And you're not supposed to be able to read this, obviously. This is just to really underline the point that this is a really complicated system that we're talking about. But what I hope to convince you of is that this very complexity, which we're sort of struggling to be able to understand and draw maps of, really allows for a lot of fine-tuning and a lot of different responses, even to a single agent like radiation. Probably quite a bit, exactly. I suspect the complexity itself is probably the same. It's just our understanding of it keeps increasing. And part of the reason for that increasing complexity, which we're seeing, is the omic revolution, which has happened recently in biology. And you're probably hearing these words thrown around, even in the press. An ome is actually defined in Webster's, I was surprised to find this, but as an abstract entity, group, or mass. And this is where you get all these phrases that you hear now. All of the DNA in the cell that Charles was talking about is the genome. You've heard the sequencing of the human genome. And the RNA is the transcriptome, all of the transcripts which are read off of the genes. So that's sort of the working template. And then you can build the proteins from that. and consider that the proteome. And there are now ways of studying all of these groups of entities, if you will. Charles showed you a little bit of the cytogenetics. You can measure genes in differences in different people, a lot of techniques here. This is a proteomic technique. What I'll be focusing on is the middle one, the RNA, and which is often referred to as functional genomics. And again, so if you think of the genome as all the DNA, if you think of all the cells in your body have the same DNA, and yet some are skin cells, some are blood cells, so what they are and what the shape of the cell is affected by which specific genes are being expressed in that cell. And so in the same way, the pattern of gene expression determines the function of the cell, but it also determines its response. So when we irradiate a cell, it can change. It still has the same DNA, but it can change what it's doing with it. It can express different genes and react in different ways. And this can also vary in different cell types. So we'll go into some of that. And I want to start out with a project which we started a while ago that's just profiling the radiation response in a very diverse set of cell lines. So we started with the NCI60 cell panel. This is a group of 60 different cell lines. They're derived from human cancers, and so there are about five or six different types of cancer that's represented by these cell lines. And they've been very well characterized. There's been a lot of study on this set of cells. So we know a lot of things about them, like their growth characteristics, what types of mutations they have in different oncogenes, these types of things. So there's a lot known. But they're also useful then for studying unique responses. And so we wanted to look at their response to radiation. And we've measured their survival after radiation, and then also looked at microarray hybridization, which is a key functional genomics approach, to measure now essentially gene expression across virtually the whole genome. And so we want to look at that and then compare it with the survival data. And just in case people aren't entirely familiar with this, it's a very powerful technique. We can now print out essentially every gene in the genome. Different spot here, each spot is a different gene. Typically, these are printed just on what look like regular glass microscope slides. And you can then extract RNA from any two populations of interest. Often, people will look at the difference between a normal tissue and a tumor to see what expression changes are happening. In our case, we will typically look at a control unirradiated sample and a sample of the same cells which has been irradiated. So we can look again at that response and see what the cell changes in order to respond to the radiation. And so here we label those two pools of RNA in different colors and hybridize them together onto this microarray. And so for each spot, we can see a different color. If we get the exact same contribution, the gene doesn't change, it's the same in both of those colored pools, we'll get a yellow spot, but if a gene goes up after the exposure to radiation, there'll be more of that particular gene that's labeled in red, and we'll get a red spot, like here. The same if it goes down, there'll be more of it before radiation, and some more of it will be green, we'll get a green spot. And one of the important things with this technique, it's very powerful, but it's not telling us the entire story of a response to stress, because that's a very dynamic thing. Some genes come up very early and go away. Some change and stay changed for a long time. It's a very dynamic process. So what we're seeing with this is a snapshot of one point in time. And so we did this, as I said, with the 60 cell lines in this cancer cell panel. And what you're looking at here is what we call a clustergram. This is just a way of representing some of this really complex data and a large number of experiments. And essentially, it's color-coded with the same pattern as those gene spots that you saw from the actual array. And so the greater the change in the upward direction, the gene that's expressed highly after radiation is going to be a darker red. And genes that are suppressed, that go down after radiation, are in brighter shades of green. And so one thing that's, so each row across this direction represents a single gene in the experiment. And each one of the columns this way is a different cell line. And so just looking at this by eye, you see this area sort of here where there seem to be a lot of genes that are very consistently downregulated, really across all of the cell lines that we're looking at. And when we look at what those genes do, lo and behold, almost all of them in this cluster here are known to have roles in regulating cell cycle progression. And as we know, we've seen in the previous slides, radiation stops cells from dividing. That's one of the things we know it does. And in fact, there's two major points it does this. There's a G1 arrest, which is largely controlled by P53, and we'll talk a little bit more about P53 in a moment. And also, there's if the cell is able to replicate its chromosomes, there's also a mechanism for stopping it before it actually divides into two cells. And that's what most of these genes appear to be involved in this process right here. So by making less of those genes, the cell then isn't making the proteins that it needs to push the cell division forward and complete this whole division. So again, to get back to the signaling pathways, though, I sort of promised you a little glimpse into this. What can we learn about signaling pathways from this experiment where we have all this richness of information, we know a lot about the cell lines, how can we start to dig down into some of these signaling reactions? So this is just a little bit simpler view than the last one I showed you of signaling. And we know that damage occurs to cells from radiation in a lot of places. Principally, DNA damage is what we think about an awful lot. You've heard some about that already. There'll be more about DNA damage. But there are also effects on the cellular membrane, even signals coming in from distant cells. Receptors may be involved. So there's a lot of parts of the cell, not just the DNA, that can be damaged by radiation. And signaling can arise from all these sites. So there are a number of different pathways here, MAP kinases, all sorts of signals that interact. What I really want to focus on now is P53. I already mentioned this. It's one of the sort of major facets of the ionizing radiation response and has been very well studied also. So we sort of know some of the signposts along the way of what to expect. And again, this is this kind of flow of events from radiation damage. You get protein modifications, a little more about that in a moment. Gene expression changes occur, which we can measure here very nicely. And then this all leads to altered cellular function. So with P53, when the cell is irradiated, one of the first things it does is activates a number of kinases, and it can modify P53 at many sites, but there's a serine at position 15 and one at position 20, which are kind of the really major sites that are altered by radiation. And so when the cell sticks a big giant phosphate group on here, this makes the P53 molecule much more stable. Normally, the P53 protein is present in your cells, but it's degraded very rapidly, so it cycles around. It's always there at a kind of low level. But after stress like radiation, you get phosphorylation. It becomes much more stable, so it accumulates in the cell. There's more of it. And these modifications also can affect the function. So it becomes activated as a transcription factor. There's a lot more of it around. And it can now go and pick out specific genes that are its target in the genome and make those be expressed much more. So another interesting thing about P53 is of all the oncogenes that we know, P53 is the most frequently mutated in cancers, in human cancers. So something over 50% of human cancers are found to have a defect in the P53 pathway. Very often, P53 is either lost or mutated. And in fact, in this cell screen panel, the NCI60 that I've been talking about, 72% of these cell lines have mutant P53. So we can look at gene expression after radiation exposure as a function of P53 function. And again, the same color coding here. And we're looking at mutant cell lines on this side and the wild type lines over here. And you can see very clearly there's a patch of genes that seem to be very strongly upregulated if P53 is there, if you have wild-type P53 in the cells. But if you don't, this is just kind of noisy, not really a coherent pattern. And when we look a little more closely at the genes in that group, we can drill down on individual genes and confirm that, yes, indeed, you require P53 for radiation induction of these genes. And these are just a few examples shown here in one cell line with P53 wild type, and then a targeted knockout, so the same cell just missing the P53 gene. And down here we see that these genes just do not respond to radiation at all without P53. So what else does P53 do? I've shown, okay, some genes change. What can that really mean for the cell? Well, I don't know how well you can read all of these down here, but just to know that these are just some of the commonly regulated genes known to respond to P53. There's predictions that there may be several hundred genes that are targets of P53 in different circumstances. At the top of this chart, we've got several categories, including cell cycle, which I already mentioned, apoptosis, which is this programmed cell death, way for cell to kill itself when it's in desperate situation. Also genes involved in DNA repair and senescence and several other different cellular functions. But this is really kind of the key point I want to make. We have both cell cycle arrest and apoptosis being upregulated potentially by the same transcription factor, by P53. So this might seem sort of a little, you know, these are almost opposite effects. Either the cell lives or it dies. Why is it trying to do both at the same time? And the answer to that is this is all part of this fine-tuning system that I was talking about. So you have many factors that are interacting here. It's not just like an on-off switch. P53 goes on, you know, one thing happens, one, two, three. None of this is linear. We know some of the factors that determine whether a cell undergoes apoptosis or cell cycle arrest in response to P53 upregulation. These include dose. If you have lower doses with less DNA damage, you're more likely to see a cell cycle arrest and attempt at repair. If the dose is very high or you have just insurmountable amounts of DNA damage, the cell is more likely to undergo apoptosis and just die right out. The cell type also affects this. Again, these cells are different from one another. Lymphoid cells, the cells in the blood, are much more likely to undergo apoptosis. They're a lot more sensitive. I think this theme will come back in subsequent lectures where these rapidly proliferating tissues like the lining of the gut or the blood-forming cells are very sensitive to cell killing, and this contributes to a lot of the acute effects of radiation that you'll see. And also factors from outside the cells, from other parts in the body, will affect the outcome of P53 activation. I showed you just very simply a couple of the modifications, but there are other sites. We saw those two phosphorylations. There's many other sites that P53 can be modified, and that can shape its specific function through binding with other proteins and binding to different promoters, so actually activating different sets of genes. But again, the overall picture here is this is another one of these really complex systems, but it allows you the ability to fine-tune your response and the ability to sort of react to different situations in slightly different ways. So now, as you saw in the previous talk, I want to move on and talk a little bit about the potential here for gene expression to develop biodosimetry, and specifically for triage purposes. So again, why are we interested in biodosimetry? I don't know if you can read this in the back, but this is, as all of us are worried about dirty bombs, this guy is worried his own government is going to let off a dirty bomb for some conspiracy-related reason, presumably. But we're all worried about these situations where we have a lot of people out here enjoying a nice day, but none of them are wearing physical dosimetry, which if you were a nuclear worker or a radiation worker, you'd have a little film badge. People just out in the city, Times Square, wherever, are not going to have that. But if there is an incident, as you've heard, we really do need to be able to perform triage so that the few people who need treatment get the appropriate treatment, and just as importantly, as has been said before, that the people who don't need treatment can have some way of knowing that they really are okay, that they weren't exposed. So our approach to this has been to use peripheral blood, again, a very popular target. You'll be hearing a lot of these, so we want to use peripheral blood. And part of what drives this for us is not only is it an easy tissue to sample, as Charles said, but it's also, as I mentioned, very sensitive, and we see this reflected in the gene expression responses too. So we can measure a lot in blood cells. So to start these experiments, we just separated the lymphocytes from blood and irradiated them in culture and looked at the gene expression. And so when we do this on the microarray, this is one of the actual blood microarrays here, showing a couple of the targets that were upregulated. We got some nice red spots. And then looking also at the individual genes in a larger number of individual patients, we see two things that are very important if this is going to be a useful biodosimeter. First, we see the black bars here represent the baseline levels in the unirradiated blood. And you see those are all fairly close. The error bars are not too huge. And this is indicating to us that these genes are expressed at relatively similar levels in different people. And that's important because, obviously, if there is some sort of event we need to do triage for, we're not going to have a sample from before the event from each person. So we have to know that there isn't too much variability in just what everybody's level is walking around. But then we're also seeing fairly consistent induction here of all of these genes across a number of people. So this is, of course, also important that you see similar levels before irradiation and similar levels after irradiation. We've looked at this also, as Charles was showing you. We've got some dose responses here. We get fairly nice lines, the increases with increasing dose, and importantly, both at 24 hours and at 48 hours after the irradiation. So this is a fairly persistent response. As I said, with all of these gene expression things, you have to remember the time factor. They're all very dynamic, but this looks like it could be useful because these responses that we're measuring are fairly persistent in blood. They're lasting for at least a couple of days. And so what we hope to be able to do is develop these sorts of ranges where, okay, even if there's quite a bit of variability, you have a clear irradiated range compared to the unexposed range, that you really can start to bin people into dose categories. And as a next step in developing this, we want to look at actual people. I mean, it's great to do these experiments in the lab and everything's growing nicely in little plastic dishes, but what happens when real people get exposed to radiation? We are able to do some limited amounts of these types of studies because there are some cancer patients who get total body irradiation. So they get a fairly even, consistent dose over the whole body. And this is given in a number of fractions, and we can look after each successive fraction and do the same type of experiments looking at the gene expression. And so here we're seeing just a few of the genes that we pulled out of these experiments. Now, so this is in an actual person, a real cancer patient who's being irradiated twice a day. And we see a couple of genes that are familiar from our other studies. These two are very common responders in pretty much all of our experiments that we've done. But we see also a couple of additional genes which we had not seen before. Now, this is another important point. So we do see kind of that general characteristic radiation response that we saw in the laboratory experiment, but we see additional responses. And if we look at these, now this is just over the first two fractions of irradiation. And again, this kind of color coding. But what I've marked out in blue here are all the genes that are involved in immune response. And so this is kind of interesting. These genes we did not see when the cells are just growing in plastic dishes. But when the cells are circulating around the human body, they're interacting with other factors, and we're seeing some different gene expression responses. And so these are going to be important not only to know about and incorporate into our diagnostic, but also they're going to be important in terms of developing specificity. So this is an issue that isn't quite as critical with the chromosome assays that Charles was talking about before. Those can be pretty clearly related to certainly DNA damage and pretty specifically to radiation. But we're a little worried that some other factors might give some of the same gene responses. So we want to make sure that we can distinguish between radiation and things like just a generalized inflammatory response, infection, that some of these same immune genes, for instance, might be involved in, or other types of trauma or drug treatment. And, of course, considering the kind of the general usual potential confounding factors that always have to be considered in these types of population studies. So there is some work to be done yet. We certainly don't have a radiation diagnostic based on gene expression that's ready to roll out tomorrow. But I think we have a very good basis for developing this. And I just want to show you here also, this is another experiment which I think is indicating that we are going to be able to develop this kind of specificity that we will need for these studies. This is just an example showing two different cell lines here, not the whole 60, but they've been exposed to 12 different stress agents that have very different mechanisms of action. They damage the cells in very different ways. And one of the ways that these 12 agents can be divided is between genotoxic and non-genotoxic. So genotoxic agents directly damage the DNA. These non-genotoxic agents do not. And we can see, I mean, it's very clear in this very different color blocks based on that simple genotoxic, non-genotoxic. Radiation, of course, would be a genotoxic agent. This is certainly not quite yet specific enough for exactly what we want, but I think it's a step in that direction, and I think it's indicating that the information is there. We just need to understand it a little bit better to be able to apply it. So again, our kind of big picture of this type of information flow would be, again, to take a very small blood sample, finger prick, as Charles indicated, from a person who's potentially been exposed. Again, we wouldn't want to have to do the full laboratory microarray type experiment. Would not be practical for a triage situation. And so the part of this project that I haven't mentioned is the development of what you could call a lab on a chip, where this assay could be done in a little self-contained cassette. And then that could be read out into a computer for the actual information analysis to get the dose assessment and bring the triage back to the population of people who need to be assessed for potential exposure. And so with that, I'll just sum up and say again what I've hoped that you will take away from this is that there are many complex signaling pathways activated by radiation, and that transcription factors can change. This is part of the signaling pathway, and they result in changes of the genes that are being expressed, and that this is really kind of underlying all these subsequent changes that you will see. The genetic program is being shunted in a certain way to allow the cell to respond to the specific situation it finds itself in. But also the complexity of these systems and some of those horribly complicated slides I was showing allows the cell to fine-tune these responses, and so that you can have a different outcome for the same dose in a different tissue or in a different situation. And also then finally that these gene expression changes are valid in vivo. We see some of the same responses, and that we're using this to base one of our novel biodosimetry approaches on. And with that, thank you for your attention. And I think I've left time for questions.
Questions to Dr. Amundson. Let me get the light.
Yes.
How many genes are you actually looking at on those arrays?
Well, the early ones that were some of the ones I was showing you are about 19,000 genes. We've moved up now. What the arrays that we're using are 44,000 genes, and they claim that they're covering the whole genome. Again, that's a little bit of a moving target. You know, we're still sort of redefining exactly what we understand as the full genome.
What do you expect like a minimally detectable dose to be
with
this sort of?
Well,
again, that seems to be a question that we're asking about a lot of these biochemistry assays. And with a dirty bomb, you're not going to expect people to get gray amounts of dose.
Exactly.
Going to get a few rads probably in most cases.
Exactly. And yeah, the lowest dose that that we've gone down to in the human blood studies is 20 centigrade. So yeah, 20 rads. I think this is going to be sort of more use in that kind of intermediate range. And you know, the bottom limit is still to be determined. I think a lot of that will depend on how much noise there is, how much variability there is between individuals, that what we can really, you know, put a call as radiation exposed. The question, in case anyone didn't hear it, was what sort of range can be determined with these assays? While we're still trying to figure that out ourselves, this is actually the goal, and I didn't emphasize that. I don't think we're ever going to be able to say with this system, you got exactly, you know, 72.3 rads. It will be a dose range. And the hope is that those ranges will be able to correspond to an appropriate intervention. You know, are you in the range where you should have cytokine treatment? Are you in the range where you might need a bone marrow transplant? Are you in the non-detectable range where you really would not expect any ill effects? So that is kind of our goal there.
And maybe you could add that if you identified a few individuals from the 10,000 that you screened that looked as if they had a big dose, then you can go to the more elaborate techniques.
Exactly. Yes, and I think that's actually a point which I don't think anyone has mentioned yet this morning. That is actually one of the key approaches of our center overall, is to have a number of complementary approaches to biodosimetry, not with the thought that one approach is going to answer all questions or be the assay, but to have sort of a hierarchy where you can screen people rapidly through one and then winnow out of them some that maybe need to have a little bit more intricate dosimetry done. You know, okay, we've got a range here. Now we're going to do the next test on you to get a closer estimate. So I think that is an important point to make.
The other questions? Yes.
At what level would you say that that's important? Is it a dose of 50 rads is then required to now do further tests, or are we talking about 10 rads to do further? At what dose do you then say this is a significant dose and we might clinically or medically have to do something with this person? What dose are you thinking that is?
Right. I don't know that we've established an actual lower limit cutoff dose yet with that. But certainly, I mean, 10 rads, 50 rads, you're not really talking about clinical intervention. 50 rads in that neighborhood, you may actually want to sort of know that and keep that information, because that's the sort of doses where you're getting concerned about later follow-up, that you may have an increased cancer risk at some of those lower levels. So certainly, if we can get that information and get that into a person's medical record, I think that would be very valuable.
Yeah?
There's a lot of focus on in utero radiation, where 50 centigrade, 100 centigrade would be clinically significant as a health physicist would be counseling somebody who's pregnant and exposed. assays that in this lecture and the previous one seem to be reaching that sort of sensitivity. And can you comment on what the use of lymphocyte depletion, I mean, we find lymphocyte depletion in many references as something mm-hmm. clinically.
Right.
Does this, at the point of where you would see, before you would see lymphocyte depletion, are you saying that some of these assays might detect the radiation?
That is certainly the idea, because one of the lymphocyte depletion has been kind of one of the gold standards in these sorts of situations. But the real problem with that, especially if you're talking about tens or hundreds of thousands of people, is that it's not sort of a point measurement. You have to watch that over many days to see that trend of depletion. So yeah, that's very much the idea of these tests, is that it would be a one-time test and you could get that information much more rapidly.
Have you looked at the possibility of using the method to screen the blood of potential suspects who are more likely to have been exposed to radiation than radioactivity rather than their victims?
I think that would be a political decision and not really a decision made by our center. But no, I hadn't. I don't know if anyone else here has thought of that. I hadn't, but it is an interesting point. And I guess if the technology is there, perhaps someone will want to implement that. But that was not one of our initial goals, at least. I think that's almost a philosophical question. Certainly, this is the dogma, is that, you know, apoptosis in general in these situations is our friend, and that it is removing badly damaged cells. Many of them, of course, like some of the karyotypes that Charles was showing, when they get really, really badly damaged, they don't have much choice but to die. They're, you know, they physically aren't going to be able to segregate those chromosomes and divide properly. So to some extent, there's a certain inevitability that, you know, if they're really badly enough damaged. And I guess kind of the first part of your question, yes, subtle changes in the genome, small mutations, which may, you know, years later lead to cancer. are not as efficiently removed as these really big catastrophic things. So it's always a balance, I think, between not wanting to kill too much of the tissue immediately because you're hoping to survive in the short term, and maybe letting some of these things slip through that cause problems years later.
Let me ask one question more just to make it more complex. Does radiation induce or cause a change in expression of any of these recently discovered genes that are involved in RNA interference?
The microRNAs. The only thing I can tell you is the broad answer, I think, is yes. We have one person in our group who is actually actively working on that. And to my knowledge, I don't think anyone else has. There isn't really anything in the literature yet about that. There is a person in the center who is actively working on that. And so far, he has found that yes, they do change in response to radiation. So I guess, again, stay tuned for hopefully interesting developments in that story.
I think you see the pattern emerging now. This course, we've never done it before, so it's very much of an experiment, and it's going to evolve. What I would say is that if you're an astronaut coming back from a shuttle mission, with all of the time in the world and all of the facilities of NASA available, what you would give is 60 milliliters of blood, and you would have a team of people like Dr. Geert spend the next week counting chromosome aberrations so that you could get an accurate assessment of the dose you received on the mission down to 5 rads. It can detect 5 rads if you take enough blood and count enough cells. But obviously, from some device exploding in Times Square with 10,000 people potentially involved, there is no way you can do that. And so we are casting about for ideas. We have a few ideas, but I would mention, I hope Dr. Brenner doesn't mind me mentioning this, part of the center is the availability of pilot grants. If you've got an idea, a better way to do this, you can apply for a pilot grant. We have money available each year to fund new ideas for how small doses of radiation may be detected in large numbers of people. Not evident in this presentations, but in the list of participating institutions, you will notice that there are a number that are experts in automation and in robotics, because one of the things you've got to do is make these tests fast and available for large numbers of people. And that's an essential part of this center.
This has been Dr. Sally Amundson's lecture, Gene Expression and Molecular Signaling Responses to Radiation. Thank you.